Oh, wrong guy. Hey, who do we have playing the Ponchielli? That would help, wouldn't it? Bruno Bartoletti conducting the National Philharmonic Orchestra in Dance of the Hours from La Gioconda. Thanks for choosing Morning Classical Music. Our financial support comes from you and also from Choral Art Camerata, presenting Spring Song, May 7th at Williston Emmanuel United Church. Tickets and information at choralart.org. And the Maine Association of Nonprofits, uniting and strengthening the nonprofit sector through management training and advocacy, nonprofitmaine.org.
Well, they don't make music the way they used to. And that's why we need Down Memory Lane. Toby here, they also keep adjusting those technological things, and we'll do what we have to keep the old music sounding good and coming your way. But here's the thing. I think it's a good thing what's happening. We're still online and now on the air around the state on something called the HD2 radio channel. And, yes, there's more. On the old-fashioned FM air on that new Maine Public Classical channel, too. So, same music, same time. Fridays at 2. But on all these different places, maybe a bit easier now for you to join me if you're up on your technology. See ya.
Our new two program schedules start Monday. To see them and for more information, including how to listen to Maine Public Classical, please visit mpbn.net. You make Maine calling possible, as does Condo Furniture of Endicott Home, offering non-toxic solutions for downsizing and living well in smaller spaces, condofurniture.com. And Husson University, offering a new bachelor's degree program in data analytics starting fall 2016. Information at husson.edu. You're listening to WMEA Portland, WMEH Bangor, WMEW Waterville, WMED Callis, WMAM Presque Isle, WMEF Fort Kent, and WMEP Camden.
Uncovering the stories of some amazing women in Maine history. This Sunday, Mother's Day, we celebrate remarkable women in our own families. But did you know that in 1952, a Portland resident who had immigrated here from rural China was named America's Mother of the Year? Toy Lengoon's story is just one of 15 compiled by writer Kate Kennedy in her book, Maine's Remarkable Women, Daughters, Wives, Sisters, and Mothers Who Shaped History. Kate's here along with two other scholars of Maine women's history to share stories reflecting the great diversity of strength and experience of Maine women. We'll learn about Marguerite Blanche Thibodeau Sear of what is now Madawaska, Cornelia Fly Rod Crosby, Sister Mildred Barker, and more. Whose story would you like to share? Maine Calling is next, but first,
live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Republican presidential candidate John Kasich's campaign says the Ohio governor plans to make an announcement at 5 p.m. Eastern. The details still unknown, but he canceled an event in Washington, D.C. this morning to return to his home state. Kasich has been trailing a distant third in the Republican race for the GOP nomination. His campaign's announcement comes after Senator Ted Cruz, the closest rival to frontrunner Donald Trump, suspended his campaign following his loss to Trump in Indiana yesterday. NPR's Sam Sanders describes a reaction among Cruz's supporters.
They said that they respect his decision. No one said that they were angry about it. Folks are already saying that he should run again in 2020 and that they would support that. But they trusted him and said if that's what he wants to do, that's what he can do. But they're not happy about it.
NPR's Sam Sanders reporting. President Obama is arriving in Flint, Michigan, where residents are still struggling with lead contamination in their drinking water. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Obama will get an on-scene update about federal efforts to help residents there.
The federal government has distributed nearly 2 million gallons of bottled water in Flint and 55,000 water filters. Last month, state and federal officials pronounced the city's filtered tap water safe to drink. But Lulu Brazell told NPR's Here and Now her family doesn't trust it.
You have to remind your kids not to drink the water, not to turn on the faucet, not to wash your hands for too long because they end up with rashes that are similar to chemical burns. So we're using bottled water for everything.
Brazell's 8-year-old daughter Mari wrote to the president on behalf of all the kids that live in Flint. Obama's planning to meet with Mari as well as Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
Turkish citizens are closer to getting visa-free travel to Europe. Terry Schultz reports the European Union's executive branch is recommending the move as part of a deal with Ankara to stem the flow of migrants and refugees to Europe.
It's a highly controversial bargain. Some EU governments criticize Ankara's record on democracy and don't want to reward the leadership by allowing citizens to take short trips to Europe without a visa. However, all EU governments want Turkey to stop potential asylum seekers from sailing to Greece across the Aegean Sea, and Ankara demands this benefit in return. European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans insists the increased interaction would be the best way to change the Turkish government's behavior.
Shouting at them and turning our backs is not going to improve the situation, and the victims of that will be ordinary Turkish citizens.
Turkey must fulfill 5 more of 72 requirements by June. The deal also needs approval from the European Parliament and EU governments. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The Dow is down nearly 92 points, or about 0.5% at 17,659. NASDAQ S&P also down. This is NPR News. Houston area authorities are investigating this morning's shooting in Katy, Texas, a suburb of Houston. The Harris County Sheriff's Office says a man who was fired this morning from night transportation opened fire in the workplace, killing one employee and injuring another before he apparently killed himself. Detroit's public school teachers are back on the job after calling in sick for 2 days to protest news that they may not be paid beyond June 30th because of the district's financial troubles. As a result, most public schools were shut down and as many as 45,000 students had to stay home. Google and Fiat Chrysler have agreed to collaborate on self-driving vehicles. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports the two companies will work together to build a fleet of minivans.
Google and Fiat Chrysler will work together to make autonomous driving technology work with the Pacifica minivan. This is the first time that Google has worked with an automaker to integrate its system into a passenger vehicle. Now, both companies' engineers will work on the project at Fiat Chrysler's engineering center outside of Detroit. A partnership between Google and a Detroit automaker was anticipated when a Detroit insider was chosen to lead the company's self-driving division. Now, we shouldn't get too excited about seeing these cars in dealerships. Google said it's not sharing its self-driving technology with Fiat Chrysler, and these particular vehicles won't be offered for sale. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
U.S. stocks are trading lower. The Dow is down 89 points at 17,661. All major market indices are down more than 0.5%. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Staples, with thousands of printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
With this look at Maine news, I'm Erwin Gratz. Franklin Memorial Hospital is laying off about 24 full-time employees and consolidating some operations to steady itself after facing $15 million in losses over the past 5 years. In a press release, Interim Chief Executive Timothy Churchill says one of the major factors contributing to the Farmington Hospital's financial losses are Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements that don't cover the full cost of care. Franklin Memorial will eliminate one of its operating rooms and close an underused radiology office in Rangeley. The organization has also imposed a wage freeze on staff. Churchill says the hospital is a leader in community health and the changes will put it on sustainable footing for the future. Islanders will be able to use locked boxes on state ferries to ship their medical samples to the mainland. The legislature approved that. Governor LePage vetoed the bill, but both houses of the legislature overrode him. The locked boxes will save islanders from making those trips with their samples. State police today identified the woman who died in a crash last night in Lebanon. She was Michelle Miller of Waterboro. State police say troopers are looking into whether Miller suffered a medical issue that caused her to lose control of her van on Depot Road last night. The van struck a tree. Miller died at the scene. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has given $5,000 to the group Friends of Fort Gorgeous. The group will use that money to develop a preservation plan for the fort, which sits near the entrance to Portland Harbor. Fort Gorgeous was built by the U.S. military during the Civil War, but never formally occupied. It was eventually given to the city. Taking a look at the weather, Clouds are expected to increase this afternoon statewide. Rain will move into southern Maine by dusk and spread northward through the night. Temperatures the rest of today will run from the upper 40s near the coast to the mid-50s inland. With that look at Maine news and weather, I'm Erwin Gratz. Maine calling time is 12:08.
From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Summer names you know. Susan Collins, Olympia Snow, Sarah Orne-Jewett, Margaret Chase Smith. Other names won't be familiar, but all have one thing in common. They have had a lasting impact on our state. Today, we're going to learn more about some of the women from Maine who you may have learned about in school and others who didn't make your high school history book. With me in our studio, Kate Kennedy. She's author of Maine's Remarkable Women, Daughters, Wives, Sisters, and Mothers Who Shaped History. Kathleen Miller is curator of the Maine Women's Writer Collection at the University of New England. Candace Keynes recently retired after serving 12 years as director of the Maine Memory Network. As always, we want to hear from you. Whose story would you like to share? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you all today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Kate, this is the second edition of this book, and you've added two new profiles. Tell me about these women, how you found out about them, and why you decided to include them in this edition of the book.
Well, when I knew that I was going to be writing a second edition, I went to the Maine Historical Society saying, who should I write about? And one of the men who works there said, well, have you ever heard of Toy Lynn Goon? And I said, no, I've never heard of her. And it turned out she was an amazing woman. She was born in southern China to a family of peasants. And she carried water as a young child, carried water on her shoulder. The house had no plumbing, no facilities of any kind. She went on to be married twice by proxy. She didn't know.
Arranged marriages.
Yes, an arranged marriage. Her second husband was not at the wedding. She hadn't met him before. He was represented by a rooster sitting in beside her during the wedding. Anyway, she came to the U.S. When he came, he had was an illegal immigrant at the time. There was the Chinese Exclusion Act, which meant no Chinese could immigrate to the United States. They ran a laundry, but he did become a citizen. Kind of a complicated story. They ran a laundry together at Woodford's Corner in Portland, a hand laundry. He died, and she raised their eight children alone, supporting them through the laundry. They went to Deering High School, and all the kids went on to higher education. She was chosen Mother of the Year for Maine in 1952 and Mother of the Year for the United States. So it's quite a story.
And we posted a photograph of her and most of her children on the steps of the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. It was a big deal in 1952 to be named Mother of the Year.
Imagine being illiterate, having choices made for you, not necessarily even against your will, but choices made about the shape of your life, and then being strong, determined, loving, hardworking, making it happen. It was amazing.
And the physical labor of running a hand laundry. Yeah. And the other new profile, it comes from Mount Desert Island.
Yes, Marguerite Yourcenar, who most American people and certainly most Mainers have rarely heard of. But if you say her name in France, everyone knows who she is. She was a brilliant 20th century writer, novelist, essayist, intellectual. She lived not as a recluse, but a quiet life on Mount Desert Island. She was a formidable gal. Everyone called her Madame. And she became the first woman chosen to be in the Académie Française, the French Academy of Letters, which is the highest honor, the highest traditional honor in French letters.
Wow. And there may be people alive today who knew Madame.
Yes. Her house is open as a museum, and the gardener was her friend and worker, still is there, and a woman named Joan Howard, who knew Madame when in her young in, in the 1980s, early 1980s, gives tours of the house.
Oh, wow. Candace, you have a particular interest in some of the early women entrepreneurs in Maine. Tell me what some of these women were up against and what they managed to do.
Well, I got interested in them because in 1920, they formed a chapter of the Business and Professional Women's Club in Portland, and it was a national organization and was a statewide organization that Margaret Chase Smith, who was well known as a member of the House of Representatives and then as a senator, was involved in. And the interesting thing about these women is what their definition of a businesswoman was. It wasn't necessarily somebody who ran what we think of as a business, but there were every sort of job occupation ranging from business owner, executive in somebody else's business, to school teachers and stenographers and bookkeepers, and any woman who was earning a living. What was at that point in the 1920s, the teens and the 20s, thought of herself as a businesswoman and was trying to open the doors for other women. So they were not necessarily, it wasn't the norm to be in business in that era, to work for a living. And especially if you were married, and some of them were, many of them were single and supported themselves through their efforts. And there are some great stories about, I know mostly the Portland stories, but there are great stories about members of that and similar organizations and what they did.
In the 1920s, would a woman entrepreneur, would she have trouble getting a loan for her business? Would she have trouble buying property to locate her business?
Absolutely. And, you know, there weren't social service kinds of support services, and there weren't things like Social Security or, child care or health care as a general rule that came along with working or at all. And so a lot of these women, I don't know how they financed what they did except by saving money. I'll give you an example. There were sisters, Mary Clarity and Nellie Clarity, who were in Portland, and their parents were Irish immigrants. And Mary, who was 10 years older, started working at a department store selling corsets. And eventually, the two of them, and then she became a buyer, and so she went to New York and learned about buying and, you know, kind of the market. And then the two sisters opened their own corset shop, and they ran it until essentially they both died. And so, I mean, that was another thing, is you could be successful, and they were very successful, but it didn't mean you had a big pile of money that allowed you to retire.
And what years was this? When did they open the corset shop?
They opened their own shop in 1906.
Oh, my goodness. And there's some irony there, because a corset often is a representation of anti-feminism,
right,
to say the least.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Kathleen, when we think of Maine women writers of years past, who comes to mind to me? Edna St. Vincent Millay, Sarah Orne Jewett. Who else would you like people to still be reading, and why?
Well, there are some really magnificent writers that have come out of this state, obviously. And one, which is Sally Wood, who was considered to be the first novelist in Maine. She wrote in the Gothic style, and she was born in 1759. She married twice, both very short marriages because her husbands died. She had several children, and she moved to Portland after her husband's died, and she was writing from about 1800 was her first publication. She wrote under the pen name A Lady of Massachusetts originally, and then A Lady of Maine, and was also known as Madame Wood. She was from a family that was allied with the English, so they had a great fortune when they came here, and then sort of that went away, but she was able to put her work out in the world, which was very unusual at that time.
Especially because she didn't take a male pen name. She said
correct.
A lady of Massachusetts, a lady of Maine.
Right. So she was a very interesting, she's a very interesting author. And recently, I'm trying to remember, I don't know if either of you know, the one of the UMaine campuses, they did a reprint just a few years ago of one of her early novels. So she has had a little bit of resurgence of interest, and she's just a fascinating figure, and she was very well known in Portland. She was kind of a, she had a very odd way of dressing, and people kind of, she was a character in Portland at that time.
Sally so, Wood, I love that.
Sally Wood. Yeah. Sally Sayward Beryl Keating Wood is her full name. Because when I first started this job, I thought, why do people have so many names?
And it's because it's so many husbands died.
All of their marriages.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, if there's someone you'd like to tell us about, maybe someone you know or someone you've read about, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Our email, talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Kate, one of the things that struck me reading the profiles in your book, Maine's Remarkable Women, is how many of them had a parent die when they were very young. Do you think that this was just what happened in real life in eras past? Or was it that was the one of the formative things, is that they had to be a certain kind of person because they didn't have a parent present?
Well, I'd say probably both. But the need to get out there and take care of yourself or take care of younger siblings, it's also amazing, Jen, how many of these women had children who died.
Oh, yeah.
Just the fact of loss from a very early age. But yes, I mean, Sister Mildred Barker, who was a Shaker sister and noted for remembering more Shaker songs than anyone in the world. She was brought to live among the Shakers at the age of 6 and was essentially lost her dad and essentially lost her mother at that time too. But so many of them needed to be tougher than I think we are nowadays, maybe. Well, we're tougher in different ways.
Right. And well, in your very first profile in the book, and I'm opening this now, Marguerite Blanche Thibodeau Sear. My goodness, what kinds of harsh conditions. I mean, she is credited with saving the early settlers of what's now Madawaska.
I loved learning about her. She is such a swashbuckler, strapping on snowshoes. And I mean, it was a sad story. Her little French-speaking village had been, people had been driven from place to place by the English and essentially had fled up the St. John River to have some land and some peace. But they struggled during a very long winter when there was snow started in September. So she worried about all the people in scattered cabins. The men had gone off hunting, and she pulled this sledge behind her loaded with food and furs and other things. She was considered very old at the time. She was 59.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I wanted to ask you, Candace, about some of the stories that stood out in your years of working in the Maine Memory Network. But I'm going to take one step back and ask you to tell our audience about Maine Memory Net and why it's such a remarkable resource for the people of Maine.
Maine Memory Network, which is www.mainemory.net, is a project of Maine Historical Society that has been around since 2001, essentially. And it is a collaboration among libraries, archives, historical societies, and museums throughout the state who put things online and images, documents, images of artifacts, and online exhibits that tell stories about
And you can
any
really get
topic.
Yourself lost in, you can get on mainmemory.net and put in a search and find remarkable photographs, which leads you to something else. And I mean, I have spent I won't use the word wasted. I have I have lost some hours of my life on Maine Memories.
I have too.
Website. It's really something.
Yeah, I often tell people it's a great thing to do on a rainy or snowy day because it will take up your whole day and you won't worry about the weather.
But the photographs especially, they really tell stories, don't they? The little details on them give away a lot.
They do. And, you know, it's a whole way of looking at history through primary sources, so through photographs, which you learn to read what is going on in a photograph, and documents that you might not otherwise see. I mean, there are so many stories about people who don't seem remarkable, but then you find out a little about them and you think, you know, lots of people are remarkable. But if they don't leave anything behind for you to find out about them, you don't always know they existed or were remarkable.
Well, I just glanced at the clock and found out we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, more from these three scholars of women history in Maine, and we'd love to hear your stories. This is Maine Calling.
Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life.
What makes for good radio listening on a Sunday evening? Maybe something a little different from Maine Public Radio. How about radio theater? I'm Susan Lowenberg, host of LA Theater Works, featured on public radio stations nationwide and in China. Now we're delighted to be on the air in Maine, Sunday nights at 9. World-class actors in contemporary and classic award-winning stage plays by our finest playwrights. For your ears only on Maine Public Radio, Sunday evenings at 9. Join us.
Hey, this is David Dye of the World Cafe. Maine is a special place for me. World Cafe has been heard on Maine Public Radio on Saturday nights for many years, and I worked in Maine for WBLM for many years before that. Well, now it seems with Maine Public Radio's expanded services, my friend Sarah Willis and I can team up to bring you 2 hours of our music each weeknight. World Cafe at 9 and In Tune at 10. Hope you can join us.
Our two new program schedules start this coming Monday. To see those schedules and for more information, including how to listen to the new Maine Public Classical Channel, visit mpbn.net.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Remarkable Women Found in Maine's History. In the studio with me, Candace Keynes. She recently retired after serving 12 years as director of the Maine Memory Network. Kate Kennedy is author of Maine's Remarkable Women, Daughters, Wives, Sisters, and Mothers Who Shaped History. Kathleen Miller is curator of the Maine Women's Writer Collection at the University of New England. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We have a note. Somebody wants to know if the guests know about Ruth Moore. She wrote books about coastal Maine. I have a feeling you know, Kathleen, about Ruth Moore.
Yes, I know a little bit about Ruth Moore. Not as much as some people, but Gary Lawless at Gulf of Maine Books is quite an expert on Ruth Moore, so he would be a fun person to chat with if you are ever up that way. And he republished a lot of her work, which was a great service to Maine literature. But yeah, Ruth Moore was a remarkable woman who she was born on Gott's Island, and she spent her childhood in Maine and then traveled around. She lived in New York for quite some time and worked for the secretary for the NAACP, did a lot of really interesting work in New York, and then came back with Eleanor Mayo to build this house on Mount Desert Island, and they lived there until both of them died. But she wrote one of her most famous novels is Spoon Handle, which was turned into a film called Deep Water, which apparently she was not pleased with. But I just finished reading Spoon Handle, and that was a really fun read. It's a beautiful picture of Maine Island life and the challenges that exist in the state, the tensions that exist between the summer people and island residents and those who are native to the place. So I think
great. And when did you write that?
That was published in 1946.
Okay, great. So we have two recommendations. We'll put these on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page, Ruth Moore and Sally Wood. We're going to go to the phones and go to Dylan, who's calling from Rangeley. Hi, Dylan. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank you for having me on your program.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask if, since you're talking about historic Maine women today, are you aware of the Flyrod Crosby Heritage Trail, which is currently being worked on by the Maine High Peaks Alliance?
Okay, so Cornelia Flyrod Crosby is one of the profiles in Kate Kennedy's book. Kate, why don't you tell us a little bit about Cornelia, and then I'll come back to you, Dylan, and you can tell us about the Heritage Trail. Go ahead, Kate.
That's wonderful to hear about the Heritage Trail. I didn't know about it. Cornelia Flyrod Crosby was one of my favorite women to write about. I heard her name, didn't know anything about her, and I said, I want to write about her. She was one of the very first sports journalists, fisherwoman, noted hunter, and really helped to establish Maine as a tourist destination at the turn of the century, and was very, very tall, wore a green leather outfit, was quite imposing at various hunting and sporting exhibits in New York and Boston and Philadelphia. She would bring a whole entourage, fish tanks, teepees, and buildings of various sorts, and she caused quite a sensation. She was also a great friend of Annie Oakley. One other thing about Flyrod was that she, as you say, she lost her father early in her life. She and her mother looked out for each other, and Flyrod lived with a lot of physical pain in her life. I was struck at the number of women who struggled with various health issues and yet had, and also had amazing accomplishments of various kinds. But she's, wow, a trail in her honor. How cool.
Dylan, tell me about the trail. Have you selected locations, and what will it be, a group of signs or something more than that?
Well, the trail has actually begun construction. I'm a Conservation Corps member working.
Oh, no, we're losing you. You must be on a cell phone. Dylan, I'm going to invite you to post some information about the Flyrod Crosby Heritage Trail on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page for our audience to look up. Thanks so much for calling. We're going to go to John, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm going to take you off a speakerphone so I can talk directly.
Great.
Yep. My name's John Shaw, and I live in Gardner. And I live in my great-grandmother's house, and she is Laura Elizabeth Richards, and there's a school in town named after her. She is, it's my understanding, she's the first Pulitzer Prize recipient for a biography that she wrote with her sister, and its 100th anniversary is this year.
Who is the biography of? And
The biography is of her mother, Julia Ward Howe.
Oh, wow.
And she and her sister wrote it, and it's, my understanding is somewhat of a cleansed version of who Julia Ward Howe was, because it doesn't mention much of her mother and father's marital strife. But she was a very accomplished woman. She won a Pulitzer Prize, and they sort of didn't know what it was when she first won it, because it was the first year, and so it was just sort of some prize.
So you have some women in your family tree.
I certainly do.
Everybody here is nodding. Candace, did you want to? No, join it. No, okay. John, thank you for sharing, and tell me again the name of your grandmother and your grandmother's book, and we'll put that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. Is it something people can buy?
Yes. Well, I don't know but there's a new book about Julia Ward Howe. My great grandmother's name is Laura Richards.
Okay. Well, great.
And she wrote a biography of her mother, Julia Ward Howe.
And did you know her? Were you alive to know her?
No, my father did. And just very briefly, she also wrote a lot of children's books, and she supported her family with children's books, and Captain January being the most famous. She was also sort of a mentor to Edwin Arlington Robinson, who won 3 Pulitzers, who was a poet who lived in Gardner, a younger man. And she and her husband, Henry Richards, not only founded the Gardner Library, but helped start the first boys' camp in Maine, Camp Merriweather, which we still go to.
Wow. Well, John, thanks so much for calling and sharing. I really appreciate it.
Certainly. My pleasure.
We're going to... Oh, go ahead. Hold on just a sec. Go ahead.
Sure. I was just going to say that at the Maine Women Writers Collection at UNE on the Portland campus, we have many, many Laura Richards books. We don't have a manuscript collection of her work, but we do have, or any significant manuscript material, but we do have those books, and people are certainly welcome to come visit us. And
is that how it works? People can come and sit in the room and read them?
Yeah, absolutely.
But those are not books to be checked out, right?
Unfortunately not, but they are there as to preserve the history of Maine writing.
Okay.
And the papers are at Maine Historical Society.
Yeah. Okay.
They're called the Yellow House Papers.
So you all know Laura Richards' story well. Wow. We're going to go on to Liz, who's calling from New Market, New Hampshire. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
I want to make sure that Mary Ellen Chase is from Maine and not New Hampshire. She was a writer in the 1940s.
Yes.
Okay.
And she wrote a wonderful book called Windswept.
Great.
And I read it, my mother's copy, when I was 11 or 12, and I was so upset because there was a woman in there who got pregnant at age 52. And out of my great knowledge, I thought, that's absolutely impossible, and they've made a mistake. And there also was a maid named Haskell that made the kids all eat up every bit of their food, and the verb was you had to Haskell your food.
and I've got a note here from my producer that Mary Ellen Chase was born in Blue Hill.
Oh, good.
And we have a collection of her papers at the Maine Women Writers Collection, which people are welcome to come visit also.
Okay. Liz, thank you for calling and sharing that. We have an email here. I am preparing a Memorial Day exhibit on Maine women in the Civil War for the Southard House Museum in Richmond. A good portion of Union nurses came from Maine. I'm seeking their personal journals, correspondences, and papers. I've already found some artifacts at the Maine Historical Society Library in Portland. Could you suggest other places I might look? And this is from Carolyn in Richmond. You guys have ideas of where she should look? Or if you're listening, you could send Maine Calling an email, and we'll connect you with Carolyn if you know of a family member who was a Union nurse in the Civil War. No? No ideas right now? It's a great idea for an exhibit. That's terrific, especially with Mercy Street on PBS right now. We'll move on to Sacco and Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. Thank you all for the work you're doing. It's wonderful. And I just wanted to call in and give a shout-out for my grandmother's 2 minutes of fame. Her name was Lucienne Pepin Belair. She was born a French-Canadian immigrant in Biddeford in 1908, and she was taken out of school to raise six of her seven siblings when she was 14. She loved education and was never able to go back and fulfill her dreams, but she ended up having two children, 6 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and she now has 3 great-great-grandchildren. She's passed, but I just wanted to give a shout-out to all the women who did the work and were more or less invisible, but she had quite an interesting life, including having her appendix out on the kitchen table when she was 8, surviving breast cancer, having pretty serious surgery for that in the 50s. She worked for the telephone company in Biddeford. A lot of my ancestors did. Her father put in one of the first phones there. And she worked, she was a married woman. She was Catholic. She unfortunately married an alcoholic who was not able to support the family and left, but could not get divorced. So her entire career as a telephone operator, she would get bumped to the back of the seniority line every time a single woman would get hired because she was married and considered less important, even though she was supporting 2 daughters on her own. So I know there are a lot of women in Maine history who just worked very hard for what they had. And we pretty much the whole family credits her with all of our intellectual curiosity and wonder about the world because she always brought that to the table, mostly because her own dreams in that area had to be delayed.
Lisa, I hope someone's writing down her story in your family.
Well, I think we're going to start because we all have different parts of the story, and it's pretty fascinating. And again, she wasn't famous, but her everyday existence was pretty extraordinary. And again, I know a lot of Maine people have that kind of a history where they worked hard and they did what needed to be done. And the French Canadians have a wonderful sense of family and fun and love, and we got that in spades. She never let her burdens, you know, get in the way of giving that to us, and we all get to pass that on, and it's really quite a celebration.
And Kate, really, this is the reason you've written this book.
Absolutely. The publisher asked me to combine well-known Maine women with unknown women. And of course, I also want to make sure that you don't think that I'm really a women's or a women's scholar or historian, because I'm just a writer.
I'm rolling my eyes right now. No. As well as I can, as far as I can.
Anyway, I wanted to mention Marguerite Zorach, who is actually quite well-known now as a painter, innovative avant-garde painter, and an amazing textile creator, bringing textiles from being a more trivialized art form to being really the amazing art form that it is. Anyway, Marguerite met her husband, William Zorach, in Paris, where they both were studying art. She was older, more confident, thought he was rather pedestrian in his artwork and needed to loosen up a bit. He was shocked that she would make purple lines around nude figures. He just couldn't understand why a nice girl like that would draw such strange shapes. Anyway, they were married, worked together, had a studio, but Marguerite lost her representation in a very well-known art gallery in New York just because she was a woman. In fact, many people feel she may have had the more stellar career, but a lot of support went to her husband, and his sculpture became very well known.
Right, and right now it's on display throughout Maine.
And she was the mother of Dolov Ipkar, who's still painting at the age of 99.
And I know that both of us have had an opportunity to meet her, one of the most wonderful people in Maine. Thank you, Lisa, so much for calling and sharing the story of your grandmother. We do have to take another short break. We're going to hear more stories when we come back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Rooster Brother, the store for cooks and those who love them at the Union River Bridge in downtown Ellsworth. And Evergreen Subaru, committed to going the extra mile for its customers. Learn more at evergreensubaru.com.
Hi, this is David Remnick. A few months ago, we launched the New Yorker Radio Hour, but we haven't been on air in Maine for one simple reason. Not enough hours in the day. Well, apparently Maine Public Radio has fixed all that. They've added hours to the day with the new Maine Public Classical Channel. So now there's more time for programs like the New Yorker Radio Hour, which is just great news. The New Yorker Radio Hour, Saturday afternoons at 3 and Sunday evenings at 11. I hope you can join us.
Hi there, Rich Tozier here, your host for Jazz Tonight, and very excited about the new Maine Public Classical Channel. You know, when you think about it, there's classic jazz, too, and even the stuff Toby plays is classic in its own way. The good news is that Maine Public Classical is bringing jazz back to Friday nights, and in a big way. 7 hours on Fridays, starting at 7, and stretching into the wee hours of Saturday morning. Hope you can join us.
Our two new program schedules start this coming Monday. To see those schedules and for more information, including how to listen to the new Maine Public Classical Channel, visit mpbn.net.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine Women in History. In the studio with me, Candace Keynes, recently retired after serving 12 years as director of the Maine Memory Network. Kathleen Miller, curator of the Maine Women's Writer Collection at UNE. Kate Kennedy, the author of the book Maine's Remarkable Women, Daughters, Wives, Sisters, and Mothers Who Shaped History. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. I think we need 2 hours for this program. So many great stories to tell. Candace, you are involved in a project that's pretty awesome that's going to culminate in 2019. Why don't you tell us about it?
A group of mostly historians in Maine are working on developing an exhibit and educational materials relating to the history of suffrage. So American women got the right to vote in 1920, but the effort to get the vote for women started in 1848, a few years later in Maine. So we are trying to gather materials. We're hoping people will come forward with information that they have about relatives who were involved in the pro or anti-suffrage movements, as both were very active in Maine. Come forward with photographs, artifacts, anything that you have that's about suffrage. And we're going to be trying to gather everything we can and, as I said, put together both an exhibit that will be at the Maine State Museum starting in 1919 and be up for about a year.
In 2019, I hope.
2019, correct. Thank you. I live in the past. So if you have anything that you want to share, you can email maine.museum@maine.gov. And we would be happy to get back to you and talk about what you have and what we're doing.
Sure, and I'll post that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook
great.
Page.
That would be really great. And I just wanted to mention somebody who is fairly well known to scholars and probably to Kathleen, who was a journalist who was involved in promoting suffrage and women's rights in general, and that was Elizabeth Oakes Smith, who was born in North Yarmouth and lived from 1806 to 1893. She was married to a man who was much older than she was and ended up essentially supporting the family. He was also a well-known journalist, Seba Smith. She ended up essentially supporting the family through her writing for a long time, but she wrote, starting in 1850, she wrote a series of essays that were in newspapers and then published about women's rights and women's suffrage. And she was the self-proclaimed first woman to climb Katahdin in 1849 and wrote a really fascinating account of that. But also, I wonder, she reminds me of another journalist who I think is pretty remarkable, who people probably don't know about. And she lived almost a century later, and her name was Emmy Bailey Whitney. And she wrote for the Lewiston Journal, and especially for the Lewiston Journal Saturday Magazine, and wrote just wonderful profiles and feature stories. But she also was very interested in the outdoors. And her husband was, his name was George Whitney, and he was an amazing photographer. And so he, an amateur photographer, he went around with her on these assignments, which is how I found out about her, because the Maine Historical Society has a collection of the photographs they took. But they went climbing and hiking constantly, especially in what is now Baxter State Park. And there are these fabulous pictures of her in a skirt, of course, as was Elizabeth Oakes Smith, you know, on top of mountains. And anyway, great stories about women who were interested in the outdoors, women's rights, and were published journalists.
We're going to go to Weston and Sylvia. Hi, Sylvia. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for this program. I'm a Frances Perkins Scholar from Mount Holyoke College. That's the program for older women returning to college. And I was so surprised to find out that she had been born in Maine once I moved here, and that there was her house is open for, you know, visiting. But I have a question to ask your scholars there, and that is that it seems that Maine has a plethora of outstanding women, and it seems like there is more here than in any other state. Would your authors that you've got there know about those statistics by any chance?
Hard thing to quantify. Candace, is there something in the water here?
Well, I always hate to claim that Maine has more of anything than anybody else, but or is more unusual, because you always think that about where you are. But I have a feeling it's partly the way Maine has developed economically and where we're located, that does lead to a need for women to be more independent, more entrepreneurial. Even today, when, you know, the joke, which isn't a joke, is that, you know, you have to have three or four jobs to survive in Maine, and that's always been true, which has led to, you know, women being active, even, you know, on farms, small businesses, all sorts of things. But whether it's more than other states, I can't say.
Right. Well, thank you, Sylvia, for calling. And I want to call out the Frances Perkins House on the Mid-Coast, which I believe in the summer only is open on selected days. It's really, really quite something. Thanks for calling. We have an email from Bill regarding remarkable Maine women. What about Kate Furbush, a distant cousin of mine, famed Maine botanist and Brunswick native? Discovery of the Furbish lousewort and aristic helped derail plans for the Dickey Lincoln Dam. Kate Kennedy, you know all about Kate Furbish, don't you?
Well, I know some. She was amazing. She was born in 1834, a family in Brunswick. She did not have to work in her life. She made she had a kind of a genteel education. She was taught how to paint and dabbled in this and dabbled in that. She went to a lecture in Boston, and a lecture about botany, and it transformed her life. She realized this is what she wanted to learn about. So she set about studying. She never went to any kind of advanced education. She did it all on her own. And she's part of a cadre of 19th century amateurs, people who learned amazing things, especially in science, studied them but were not affiliated with a university or any organization. They simply did it on their own. She traveled all over the state of Maine, tramping, talk about long skirts, tramped all through Aroostook County when it was called the Aroostook. She gathered every single flowering plant, every single plant, I believe, in the state of Maine, cataloged it, and also painted it, which is an extraordinary life's work. She is just one of my idols. She was tiny in person, but very large in power and force of character, and was told often she shouldn't be doing what she was doing. Her folios, these big, very large books of her paintings, are on exhibit at the Rare Book Room at Bowdoin College, and anybody can go in and ask to see them. I think it will change you forever. It's so beautiful, the work that she did. Can I read just one little thing that she said,
sure,
Jen? Toward the end of her life, she didn't marry. She lived alone. She said, called crazy a fool, and this is the way that my work has been done, the flowers being my only society and the manuals the only literature for months together. Happy, happy hours.
Oh, wow. Wow. We have two related tweets that I want to bring up. One's from Molly and one's from Laura. One writes, sometimes you got to call out friends. And this is us. At Maine Calling, we don't ask which men deserve a place in history. And Laura Sears says something similar. We never ask which men should be included in the history books. Maine women in history deserve more than that. Candace, you've been a scholar of women's history. This is, I'm sure, something that comes up. Why is women's history an academic pursuit? Explain to those, especially maybe young people who say, why are we having this program today?
Well, obviously women's history has been around for a long time, but it wasn't until really the 1960s that people started calling themselves historians of women and departments focusing on women's history. And that's because history for a long time had really focused on things like politics and the military and mostly pursuits that were limited to men. And sometimes we think that terms are neutral. I'll give you an example. I love looking at newspapers where they have sports scores, and it will say basketball, and then it's all men's teams, and then it'll say women's basketball. And then it has those scores separate. So we think of often of the term history as neutral, but in reality, it often is history about men. And so sometimes you don't get the other stories until you start looking at things differently and from a different perspective. And so it isn't only women who write women's history, but it's anybody who is looking at issues of gender and race and other things that start seeing the stories that are hidden with some of the older ways, I might say, of looking at history.
And I'll send this question to you as well, Kathleen. You are the curator of the Maine Women's Writer Collection. What do we learn from women's writing collection that we wouldn't learn or may learn differently from a Maine writer's collection?
Well, I mean, I think the question of why we collect women's voices specifically is one that always comes up in my work. And I think what women struggle against to create that work historically and still is, you know, women are having kids, they're taking care of their families, and they're writing books, and they're doing all these other things. And, you know, we haven't even talked about, like, in the history of Maine, we haven't even talked about Native women or, you know, any, there are so many layers of what people's voices. So in our collection, we have women's diaries, which tell the stories of women who didn't have the luxury of writing books or didn't have time to become educated, but they wrote little notes about their lives. And those tell us really important details about history that is not written in the history books.
And one of our emails wants us to mention Molly Molasses, speaking of Native
Correct.
American women, a famous member of the Penobscot Nation. And Bunny McBride did a biography of her, wrote a biography called
yes.
Women of the Dawn. So that email is from Allison. Kate Kennedy, you mentioned, you write a profile of Florence Nicolar Shea in your book, Maine's Remarkable Women. We have another person wants us to bring up Abby Burgess Grant, the lighthouse keeper on Matinicus Rock. So you all are all nodding. She's not an author, but somebody you can learn about. This email says, at the lighthouse, you can learn about her and other female lighthouse keepers at the Lighthouse Museum in Rockland. I think we have time for one more call, so we're going to go to Jenny, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jenny, go ahead.
Hi, just a quick question. Has anyone ever heard of Abigail Wheelock from Portland? There's a grave area in Evergreen Cemetery that's for a home for unwed women, and it was started by Ms. Wheelock in the 1800s and continued into the 1900s. And I just thought that seemed like an unusual situation to be happening as a woman wealthy enough to open her home and start a home for unwed women, and it lasted for over 100 years.
And that says, can you spell Wheelock for us?
W-H-E-E-L-O-C-K. She was born in 1788 and died in 1877.
And how did you learn about her, Jenny?
I go walking past them almost every day.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's a great story.
Probably about 34, 35 different headstones of the women that lived there. So,
Candace.
I don't know specifically about her, but I do know that the Friends of Evergreen Cemetery have compiled a number of walking trails through the cemetery, and one of them is about the women of Evergreen Cemetery. And I can't say right now if she's in there or not, but
she
very well may be.
Well,
story in there anyway, somewhere anyways. But thank you.
Yeah,
Jenny,
thank
thanks
you.
So much for calling.
Great.
And that was a quick call, so we're going to go to one more. Sandra calling from West Scarborough. Hi, Sandra, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the Fly Rod Crosby Trail is a 45-mile trail. It will be. It will go from Strong to Rangeley. Fly Rod Crosby is buried in Strong, but grew up and lived in Phillips, and I currently own the house that she grew up in. And she, when her father died, she and her mother couldn't afford to keep it, and so she built a little cottage next door, and that was called St. Anthony's Cottage, and she was Catholic, and she lived there until she died in 1946. And there are no markers on these houses, and actually the house, her brick house that I own, is currently for sale and under contract. But if you drive through Phillips or if you are looking at Fly Rod Crosby's things and anything on her, there's the Phillips phonograph, and all her writings are there at the Historical Society in Phillips.
Well, Sandra, thank you so much for calling, and I really appreciate it. We're almost out of time, so I'm just going to have to say thank you to you all. Kate Kennedy, the author of Maine's Remarkable Women, Daughters, Wives, Sisters, and Mothers Who Shaped History. Kathleen Miller is curator of the Maine Women's Writer Collection at the University of New England, and Candace Keynes recently retired after serving 12 years as director of the Maine Memory Network, now working on other projects. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the new changes coming Monday for Maine Public Radio. Learn about our new classical music channel and the new schedule right here on this channel. Starting Monday, we'll be on at 1 o'clock instead of noon. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
Bangor, WMEW HD Waterville, WMEM HD Presque Isle, WMEF HD Fort Kent, WMED HD.